Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's big love, pop art, and fun times from the Wilson World Studios in California, USA. It's Big Pop Fun. Here's Tom Wilson.
Welcome, everybody. Hey, it's the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. I'm Tom. Yes, that's right. Tom's my first name. Wilson's my last name. It's my second. All right, my middle name is Francis. Do what you want with it. Go ahead. Francis is a fine, fine name. Thomas and Francis. I'm named after, famous Jewish prophets from the Old Testament. Welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we snuggle up close together in this season of love and sharing and laughter and wonder when Tom's going to just get with it and introduce the guest. I'm getting there. This podcast is always brought to you by my book, The Masked Man. If you haven't read it, why not read a book? Why not? Get out there and read. Don't just read, two paragraphs of some internet report that you've read and the comment section. I have hope for humanity. And then I read the comments section of articles on the web, and yes, you lose it very quickly. But hey, read a book and read The Masked Man. It's doing very well, and it's always brought to you by art. So support art, support artists, and go out and buy something like a ticket to a show or a concert, or just buy a musical instrument and make some joyful noises in this beautiful season. I saw a movie. Can I cheat? The Screen Actors Guild has, as you might have heard of, the SAG Awards, the Screen Actors Guild Awards, where the union that represents actors gives awards, deserving awards, to actors, to casts, to all sorts of people, and it's on TV somewhere in January, something like that. Anyway, many people get selected to be on the nominating committee for the Screen Actors Guild Awards. And this year, I was selected to be on the nominating committee for performances in film for the Screen Actors Guild Award, which is, it's really quite something. I mean, I agreed to do it, and there are challenges to it. Really going out there and trying to see a lot of movies. And there are perks to it. Many of the movie companies, because they think, well, Tom might not want to go out to screenings of every movie that's out there, so we will send him a DVD. So when you were on the nominating committee of performances in motion picture for the Screen Actors Guild, you get a lot of really cool DVDs way before everyone else does. Yes, you get DVDs of movies that haven't even been released in theaters yet in order to watch them and see the performances there. And I've enjoyed a lot of them. But last night I was blown away because I went to a screening to see the new production, the new movie of Les Miserables, directed by Tom Hooper, who directed The King's Speech and many other really very, very fine movies, starring Hugh Jackman, Anne Hathaway, Russell Crowe, Eddie Redmayne. I mean, anyway, can I tell you, people, maybe you're not a Les Mis-like person, or maybe you're one who the somewhat sentimental, the somewhat heart-driven show begins to have you roll your eyes or say, oh, one of these pulling the heartstrings thing. Would you do me a favor and go to the movie theater and see this movie, Les Miserables? I mean, I'm saying this, believe me, because Tom is the man who hates everything. Yeah, I'm the cranky guy now because I am the one in the movie theater. I very rarely go and pay that $15 or $16, whatever is now in LA. I don't know what it is where you are, but it's not cheap at all to go to a movie. Yes, because movies cost a lot of money to make and a lot of money to hype and a lot of money to buy commercials for and a lot of money to pay stars $20, $30 million and a lot of money to not pay character actors. It blew my socks off. And again, I'm this guy who sits in the movie theater at the end and the lights come up and everyone's like, well, that was pretty good, huh? And I'm the one saying, they so much effort by so many artists wasted on garbage. I think, oh, Tom, you hate everything. Well, yes, I do hate everything because everything is terrible. I hate things that are bad. Therefore, Kojito Ergo Sum is, I think, therefore I am. Me with movies is, I see, therefore I hate. I don't know what that is in Latin. So I see Les Mis, and I know. And I'm not going to say much about it because I'm not going to ruin anything for you or for audience members. But at the end, I gave, along with the theater I was in, with Screen Actors Guild members and the nominating committee, I gave it a rousing standing ovation. And I couldn't stop saying the word wow. I just kept going, wow, wow. So if you get a chance, and you will get a chance on Christmas Day, believe me, since I'm not cast in them much anymore, you know, I'm not the big friend of the gigantic movie musical that I would have loved to have been in. And a lot of times I feel like, yeah, well, you know, Hugh Jackman doesn't need my help. Go for it, Hugh. Spend another jillion, you know, buy yourself a yacht on the Les Miserables money. But hey, Hugh Jackman deserves the Best Actor award, as does Anne Hathaway. I mean, it's just I marvel at a movie like that, and I super loved it. So go see it, and it's almost time. I have more movies to see. I have to watch a lot of movies. It's almost time for me to cast my ballot to nominate all these people for awards, and they give you a big book. Not a book, but, you know, it's a booklet, but there are a lot of pages in it because the movie companies send out advertising and requests that the Screen Actors Guild would take into consideration their person in their movie to be given an award. Now, that happened to me. I think one the first Back to the Future, second, whatever. The studio can take out a big ad in Variety or in the Hollywood Reporter and say, for your consideration, you know. And back then it was Thomas F. Wilson, Best Supporting Actor or whatever. So they have these ads and this effort. Well, all these names go into this booklet that I get in order to nominate people for the Screen Actors Guild Award. And there are many, many names in the book. And it's just surprising that there are so, so many names. You know, back years ago, people would say, well, you're in the book, you're under consideration for the Academy Award. And I was a kid, so I'm like, wow, that's really, you know, telling my parents, I think I'm under consideration for an Academy Award. Well, the Academy Awards. Well, now I saw the book of actors' names that are under consideration. It's pretty long. Featured actors on the list were, of course, it's Hugh Jackman and probably Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln. Although I sometimes point out the award is for best acting, not most acting, but it is a fine award. Tom Arnold is also under consideration for. No, that's not kidding. Yes, you run through people. Well, who should I nominate here? Tom Arnold, Eva Longoria, many, many people. But I'm so glad that I'm on the committee that just allowed me to see Les Miserables in this thing because it's a great movie. And I think you should go see it. My friend Harry Basil is a movie director. Yes. He's directed Burt Reynolds, who I'm sure has been under consideration for Oscars and Screen Actors Guild Awards. He's directed Chevy Chase, who maybe O Heavenly Dog was under consideration at one point. And he's done many movies with Rodney Dangerfield. The part one was last week. If you haven't listened to part one with Harry, I recommend you do because Harry has lived a fascinating life of an artist. In this one, we get into his relationship, his fascinating relationship with Rodney Dangerfield, and becoming a director, a writer of movies. also a stand-up comedian. So I hope that you enjoy part two of my conversation with my friend, Harry Basil.
Big Pop Fun.
When you were really good at stand-up, mm-hmm. when things are going very well and you're doing spin-offs of TV shows and you were almost right. in Saturday Night Live and that kind of thing, is that when you did the HBO Young Comics and met
yeah,
Rodney?
While all of that was going on, or even actually right before that, I got cast in one of Rodney's HBO specials. And back then they were doing the Young Comedian specials. Were you ever in one of those?
No.
Okay. Well, they did one at the Comedy Store. I think Carl Reiner was the host of it. And this was the 9th annual Young Comedian special. And Rodney was just getting hot. You know, I mean, he had done Easy Money. And, he'd just come off of Caddyshack, so he's a movie star now. And then, of course, he had, his appearances on, The Tonight Show and Sullivan and whatnot. So they asked Rodney to host this Young Comedian special. And he said, okay, but I want to be able to pick the comics. He wanted to handpick the comics. And I remember I had a showcase in the main room, and I killed, and he really loved it, and he wanted me on the show. But then they found out how expensive it was going to be for the music,
For you to be on
like
the show.
$50,000 a song, mm-hmm. And John Williams would have made a fortune off of this because my whole act was like old John Williams music. So he goes, okay, you could do a couple of bits, do the sword bit. I did this Excalibur bit where I pulled a sword out of a woman's groin. And you could do the Risky Business. And then we recorded the music. And I think Michael Becker did the piano. And Rex Meredith sang old time rock and roll for me, did like a Bob Seger on it. So that's all I got to do. And I didn't really break out from the special, but it was a great credit at the time. A lot of people recognized me. But there were a lot of other people on that HBO special that really broke out. And it was Sam Kennison was on it, Bob Saget, Yakov Smirnoff, Louis Anderson, Rita Rudner, Bob Nelson, and Maurice LaMarche. It was huge.
Yeah, it's a who's who practically.
And it wound up and Carol Leifer was cut out. She was cut out. And Rodney handpicked all these comics, and it became the highest rated Young Comedian special ever. So they decided to give Rodney his own special every year after that. They continued with the Young Comedian special series, which they did about maybe four more after that, but it would be a Rodney Dangerfield special. Nothing mm-hmm. goes right. And Rodney continued using amazing comics. I think the second one had Roseanne in it, Kennison again, Bob Nelson, Jerry Seinfeld, Jeff Altman, Robert Townsend, the one after that, Dice, Schimmel, Lenny Clark, Barry Sobel. So a lot of comics became huge, and Sam and Sam Kennison and Dice became superstars from Rodney's specials. Anyway, so that was it. That was my only thing with Rodney. That I remember the night of, and this is all in 1984, and I remember Rodney saying, man, you're really funny. I'm doing this movie Back to School. Maybe you'd be good to play my son in it. So he got me, auditions. I had screen tests, and I didn't get the part. Keith Gordon wound up getting the part. But that same week, I got Peggy Sue Got Married. So this all happened before the NBC thing. So Rodney was always very cordial to me. I'd see him at events. I'd see him with Kennison at the store. Hey, Harry, how you doing? Okay. Really didn't know me that well. Just knew me as that prop comic that was in his special. How's the monster doing? He would say to me. Because I remember I did a line when I was putting my pants on. Oh, it's time to put the monster away. And Rodney would always remember a joke or a bit. And he would always say, hey, how's the monster doing? So then it cut to a couple of years later after Rodney's done a few specials. And Rodney decides he wants to do a live show, Rodney Dangerfield and Friends, down in Long Beach at the Performing Arts Center. And he's like, oh, man, I won't have to headline. I'll host it. And I'll introduce the comedians from my specials. And it was Schimmel, Saget, and me. And Rodney had never seen my full act before. He had only seen what I showcased. So I remember in my rider, I had that I had to have a wireless lav mic if it held over like 1,000 seats because of running all around. So how there's things in your rider that you don't even like pay attention to.
Right.
So I guess they ordered the wireless lav. But during rehearsals, I realized I didn't need it. So I said, no, I won't need the lav. Well, I didn't know that Rodney had to rent it You know what I mean? They didn't have it at the theater. Man, what the F? Why'd you do this, man? You said you needed it and you're not using it and cost me F and money. And he's cursing at me and yelling at me. And we were getting paid like $1,000 for the gig in the dressing room. Rodney had a bin with hot dogs and dirty water or whatever. And he was like, hey, man, we got hot dogs back there, you know? And I'm like, this is a like a night. It was almost like, remember the gig we did with Binder, how we just kept complaining
with
about
Mike
it?
Mike Binder, yeah, it was in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Yeah, it was like a nightmare gig. Even though it was with Rodney, I'm like going, this, you know, I'm making more money than this and it's a better venue and blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, so he yells at me. I'm pissed off. And I start screaming at Saget, and Saget is real tight with Rodney. And Saget goes up to Rodney and goes, you know, Harry's really offended. You yelled at him, this, that. And so Rodney apologized. Man, I was out of line, man. I never should have done that. It's petty, man. It's absolutely petty. I know you didn't know. I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. So this is all before. And I get to see this real sweet side of him. And while all this is happening, I'm looking at his testicles because, you know, Rodney was always naked in a robe and his balls were hanging out. So that might have been the first time I saw his balls. Anyway,
let me get a pen.
So I wind up doing the show and I kill, have an unbelievable show, standing ovation. Rodney, man, you're out of hand. Holy mackerel. How'd you like to open for me? Right? So that's the first time he asked me to open for him. Then we're all hanging out and he goes, man, you do movies. You ever write any movies before? And I said, oh, I just read a book called How to Write a Screenplay in 21 Days, which Steve Oderkirk had given me, and I had bought Steve's compact computer laptop off of him.
Oh, yeah.
So Steve sold me a computer with a writing program on it and gave me this book, you know. So I just learned how to write a screenplay. And I said, yeah, I know how to write screenplays. Oh, man, maybe we'll do something sometime, you know. So this was like a great night, from getting yelled at about the lav and the hot dogs to how'd you like to open for me and how'd you like to write a movie together someday. So I don't hear from him, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, maybe he was stoned, which he was. But then he calls me and asks me to open for him, I think at Bally's. And I wound up, like, opening for him. And then he had me play Valley Forge and Westbury. And
well, you ended up opening for Rodney
for 20 years, yes, 17,
for
20 years.
20 yeah, years yeah. of opening for Rodney at all of his shows. I mean, you and I mean, you brought me in. We opened for him at the Palace
yeah.
in Auburn Hills, Michigan, to 19,000 people.
That was awesome.
That was quite a...
I have a great photo you took of me from behind me. I'm holding the sword, and you could just see all these people out there.
Just thousands yeah, and thousands
it was
of
pretty
people.
Wild. And it was the night of the, well, when the first Bush was in office, when they bombed Saddam.
Right, we had dinner with Rodney.
And Eddie Shine. Night. And Eddie Shine.
Yes. So Rodney called me in my hotel room. Tom, we're having a little dinner in my room if you want to come down and everything. Yeah. And as you said, Rodney, no kidding, you would go down and knock on the door, and he would open it in a silk bathrobe with poker chips on it
yeah.
and stuff and playing cards.
Yeah.
Completely opened. Like yeah. like not even trying to close it.
Yeah.
Completely opened at his shoulders
yeah.
with a gigantic
belly
with a huge kind of heart surgery scar going up his chest. And I mean stark
yeah,
naked.
Yeah.
In a hotel, in the hallway of the
yeah,
hotel.
Yeah, how you doing, man?
Hey, man, come on in.
It's like a steam room. Like the whole world was a steam room.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah.
like, what in the world? Okay.
Yeah.
And we sat down to have a very nice dinner. I mean, he ordered a lot of great, great special food and everything.
Yeah.
And we had a very nice dinner. But he sat there with his friend, Eddie.
Yeah.
Basically stark naked.
Yeah.
And ate.
And while we were eating, CNN was on and the war was unfolding. The tanks were there. They were on the ground and all that, you know.
And he was sure.
Or no, wait, that wasn't a ground war, but yeah.
He was sure that it was Armageddon.
He was like, man, it's all because of the Jews, okay? They're going to find a way to blame this on the Jews. He kept saying that, you know, man, you know who this is going to be bad for? The Jews. Because they always wind up finding a way to pin it on the Jews, you know? He was Jewish. And, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
So I started, you know, opening for him. And sometimes I wouldn't get calls and I thought something was wrong. But then I realized he just wasn't working. You know, some weeks he just wouldn't go out, you
yeah.
know?
While we're on Rod, can we talk a little about the Dunes Hotel
sure.
in Las Vegas? Because I was performing there a lot and you were performing there a lot.
We worked a lot together.
You were doing crazy things at the Dunes Hotel on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bringing people on stage This is a huge Las Vegas showroom.
Right.
In the busiest interstate. Well, now the Dunes was destroyed, and now that's where the Bellagio is now in Las Vegas. But it's
the Bellagio, the Monte Carlo, and the New York, because they had a golf course.
That's true.
So it went from Flamingo all the way down to Tropicana to the I-15, from the I-15 to Las Vegas Boulevard.
It's almost crazy at that time to think that the Dunes did have an 18-hole golf course right behind it.
Yeah.
Like right there in Las Vegas that they sold, as you said, to build two additional entire resort hotels.
Right, right.
But you are there. We're in the main showroom at the Dunes Hotel in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're bringing people on stage. You're running all over. Steve went on stage in an Elvis outfit and like did the fake throw up with mushroom
soup. We used to do crazy stuff.
All kinds of crazy stuff. You and I had, remember we put up signs in the elevators that we were having a garage sale?
Yeah.
And we were just taking lamps from places and we're trying to sell them
to people. We did it outside my room on the floor in the new
hallway.
Tower. And we had tables with lamps and ashtrays and anything we could take from the room. But we put signs everywhere.
Garage sale.
Yard sale on the 12th floor, room so-and-so. And we taped these all over the place just for our own amusement.
Well, you're in a hotel in Las Vegas and you're young guys.
Yeah.
And we went up near the roof. There was a hidden staircase that we went to that overlooked the whole parking lot.
No, you can get on the roof up there. We used to go up on the roof, and there was a pool and some cabanas, and they said that some sheik used, the only one who would ever get to use that was some sheik and all of his wives, and you could stand up there and look over and everything.
Yeah, but you could stand up at the remember the staircase was hidden by walls of bricks with about a 3-foot little hole where you could see out, and you got one of those surgical tubing slingshots.
Shot water balloons?
Yeah, we were shooting water balloons off
terrible.
Of, I don't know what it was, the 15th floor
that's
or something.
That's terrible. Oh, my God.
Do you remember?
Do you remember that slingshot? One night we had it at the store, and we're in the parking lot, and Blake Clark is going to use it, okay? And he's going to shoot one up at a window at the Hyatt House, okay? Uh-huh. And basically, you're holding each end of it like a slingshot. And then the sack that has the water balloon has a strap on it, and you hold it down with your foot. So that's being held down by your foot, and then your arms are holding this the surgical material extended, and then you launch it. So he launches it up at a window because it was an open window at the Hyatt House, and he hit another window and shattered it.
Oh.
And so between the glass shattering and all the water, like 10 comedians, like little boys, just all running hot.
Yeah, sure, of course.
You know, and we're just hiding. And then we all start to peek out and realize, okay, it's an empty room. Nobody's looked out, you know. It was terrible. We were like little kids.
But you brought the woman with the thick sweater onto the stage, didn't you? Where you inhaled her hair?
I threw up on a woman once. I was... Well,
in Las Vegas, didn't you glue the guy's hand to his own head?
That happened in Utah at cartoons. Yeah. I glued a guy's finger to his head. That was horrible. I thought I was going to be out of the business.
Well, you did. I mean, you were doing a lot. You didn't
I used a lot
jump,
of people.
Yeah. You didn't only jump four guys with a scooter.
No, you were doing
lots of kind of crazy things.
I had
things
a lot of
stage.
Lot of nightmare things happen. Like, you know, I pulled a lot of toupees off of people's heads and had, you know, women's boobs fall out of their halters while they were doing the Superman. But yeah, the throw up incident was in Georgia, and I'm at a club, and I'm doing the Superman bit, and we're laying on a stool flying, and I inhaled this woman's hair into my throat, and I kind of swallowed it, and as I pulled my head away, it tickled my throat, and I threw up all over her. On her back and her hair, and the audience gasped. We stopped the music. Oh, this is 10 minutes into my act, and I got to tell this woman, I just threw up on you. She screams and runs to the ladies' room and cleans up. I go brush my teeth. MC comes back on stage. They gave her a free T-shirt, you know, funny bone T-shirt or whatever. And now I have to explain to the audience what happened. And as I'm telling the story, and I start to explain it, I'm about to gag again, and they're backing away from me, and I almost can't get the story out without throwing up. But I had a couple of incidents with vomit. Remember I used to drink the egg in Rocky and spit it out?
Yes, you did.
I was in Detroit once, and there was a drunk guy in the front row, and I drank the egg, and I spit it out, and I put it down, and I'm saying, thank you, good night, and he stands up and faces the audience and drinks the spit-out egg and swallows it, and a woman next to him just puked all over her whole table. So I'm like, thank you. Good night. You know, it's terrible.
The end of a Harry show, folks, would be Harry, you know, like that scene in Rocky. Yes, he cracks the egg. He empties it into a clear glass. So you can see it's the egg.
Yeah.
And Harry, the audience is saying, oh, drink it, whatever. Yeah. So Harry drinks the egg triumphantly, but then becomes sickened and spits the entire egg back into the glass, which creates,
right.
And then the guy stands up, drinks the egg.
And swallows it and swallows it. And the woman next to him just loses it. You know,
but I'm trying to. This is the kind of
and
stuff
Jonah Pody's
that you were
doing. Sister was in the audience that night. She came to see me. It was in Detroit or whatever. So it's like here she is watching my show and is like, is this all part of it? You know,
but a lot of crazy things would happen with your act because you had so much audience participation.
Yeah.
You would fight guys in the Rocky scene, or you would have a guy dress up like Ivan Drago Dolph Lundgren.
There was a big fat guy once, like bigger than Chris Farley, and he's in it. And then he and I are like supposed to fake punch, and I kind of whispered to him to fall, and he fell on me. And this big fat guy is laying on top of me and all sweaty, and the music is playing, and I can't get up to finish the show. So the music just ran out because I'm hysterically laughing. He's hysterically laughing, and you know, there's just things just don't go right.
But
sometimes.
This is the guy who was opening for Rodney.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Rodney Dangerfield, just straight jokes.
Yeah.
Straight one-liners, you know.
He liked guys that did music or props or like Bob Nelson because he didn't want to have a guy up there for a half hour telling stories.
And then
going up and telling stories. So he always liked variety. And that's why he used Jim Carrey and Finest for a little bit, and you know.
Also, if I may revisit the Dunes, and you know, we don't have to talk about this much, but I remember the Dunes when your dad actually showed up.
Oh yeah, it was weird. He was living in a
living in a van,
and
you came up and told me this, and I thought it was a gag. I thought, oh, Harry's just goofing off because you come up and say, yeah, my dad is living in this van out in the Dunes Hotel parking lot.
Yeah,
and he wants to come to the show, so he's coming to the show tonight. I'm like, okay, great, Harry. No, I'm serious.
Yeah,
my dad. I go, Harry, your dad does not. No, seriously, Tom, he does. My dad is living in a van.
You know, he left me with some tapes. And Steve Oderkirk and I drove to Vegas that week together, and we drove back, and I had these cassette tapes with him just saying stuff to me like for hours, and we listened to it, and I'm listening to it for the first time in front of Steve in the car, and it was just getting really weird, and I had to shut it off, and Steve was like, no, please, please, can we keep listening? He was doing like Nat King Cole impressions. He was saying how he's going to be headlining the Legends in Concert. He's going to have his nose surgically altered to look like Nat King Cole.
So your dad,
he was nuts.
Your dad came to the Dunes, and I remember because I was in that show that he came. I remember meeting your dad. He had he been around for a while, or
he had been drifting around?
But you didn't know
Arizona the year. Now then, he decided he heard I was in Vegas, so he drove there. You know, even in L.A., sometimes he'd show up and he'd just be living in his van out in the parking lot.
So your dad was in the van there in the Dunes, and it was hot.
Yeah,
I mean it was 105, 110 degrees.
Yeah,
and he was staying in a van.
Yeah,
in the parking lot, and no shade. I mean, this was
no, it was hot. You know, I'd give him some money, or he'd take some sodas from the dressing room. Remember, there was bottled water.
Yeah.
He goes, is anybody going to take those? And I was like, no, go ahead, take them.
So he had recorded a bunch of cassettes for you.
Yes, and he wanted me to listen to them.
But they were showbiz cassettes. They were like ideas that he had.
He would just talk about how he's going to get back and my mom back and get back in the kids' lives. It was real pathetic kind of stuff. You know, it was sad. You know, just a guy sitting in a hot van rambling into a tape recorder.
But it wasn't about any, like, your relationship. It was just like...
He'd talk about relationship stuff, too, but then he'd say how he's going to do this. I remember him coming up. He wanted to talk to me, and he calls me really early, and Laura was my girlfriend then, and I'm like, okay, he's going to ask me for money or whatever. So he comes up, and he has something really important to tell us, and I'm in my boxers. She's in her nightgown, and the windows, the curtains are open. He says how in 2 months... he's going to be playing the Imperial Palace as Nat King. He's pointing out the window at the hotel. And he has a crumpled up piece of paper. This sounds so sad. And he's going, pick any song on there, you know, and I'll do it for you right now. And he had all these handwritten titles of Nat King Cole stories. So Laura goes, okay, this one? I don't know that one. So he's singing like, you know, dance ballerina, dance.
Standing there.
standing in front of the window, singing for us.
Yeah.
We're in our pajamas with sleep in our eyes. She's looking over at me, holding back, you know, wanting to just burst out laughing.
But your dad is singing Dance Ballerina Dance.
Dance or Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. And he did an okay Nat King Cole, you know. But so we're like, okay, Dad, you know, good luck, you know, and all that. And he left, and she's like, man, your family is crazy. You know? It was funny.
Wow.
Yeah, it was sad. And then, you know, I remember driving home with Steve. I think it was another night because Laura was with me that one time. But the time when he came and gave me those tapes, Steve and I drove home. You know how we would leave after the show? Started driving through the desert like 2, 3 in the morning.
Yeah, remember?
And we're just listening to my dad. It was almost like, remember how John Malkovich in Line of Fire would just talk on the phone to Clint Eastwood and he'd pause and it was creepy. It was really creepy. I think I might have him somewhere.
You know? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Somewhere in a box somewhere.
But I mean, I just thought of that because Rodney Dangerfield really became a father figure.
Oh,
to you.
God, yeah. You know, it's funny
because you worked with him for so many years.
My dad got to meet Rodney right before we did the fourth tenor in '99, and he got to see my kids for the first time. It was in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I was opening for Rodney at the Beau Rivage, and my dad looked really bad, and he came backstage and Rodney met him, was nice to him, and took pictures and all. And Rodney was like, man, your dad's in a bad way, isn't he? And I remember my dad died like maybe 2 months after Rodney died, you know, in like 2004. And, you know, alone, you know, they found him in some apartment and, you know, with prescription pills. But he had a heart attack, you know. And I guess he was there for a while, you know, before someone found him. So it was sad, you know, he didn't get to really see his grandchildren or great grandchildren and all that, and it was his own choice for leaving. You know, there's a lot of people that are kind of like deadbeat dads or whatever, and they could still rekindle and have a relationship with their family, but it was like his loss. You know,
why do you think that some guys like your dad can't do that?
I think he depended upon his brother. You know, when he was an artist, he worked with his brother, my uncle. And my uncle allowed him only to get to a certain level, would deem how much he was going to pay him and this and that. So he depended upon his brother and his mother, and he was like the baby. So, you know, now he has a family, and he had vices, you know. He gambled, he womanized, and he did drugs, everything that I just did not want to do. You know what I mean? I just did not want to be like him. That's why I've never done drugs, you know. I mean, Rodney smoked pot and offered me pot. My dad was a drug addict, so I did not want to be anything like him,
yeah.
You know. And listen, I love my dad. I mean, you know, there were fun memories I remember about him. But and I always said to him, look, I'm not going to give you money anymore. If I'm going to support anyone, it's going to be mom and my brothers and sisters. That's money I could be giving to them. But if wherever I am, if I'm playing somewhere and you're there and you want to come see me, you know, I let him stay in my room a couple of times and spend time with him. So I would be warm to him like that. You know, I wouldn't like say, hey, get the hell away from me. I don't ever want to see you. That's not in me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I said, I can't let you in. I'm not, you know, like a couple times he wanted to move to where I lived. And I said, Dad, no, I can't have that. I don't want it to end bad. I don't want it to end ugly. You know what I mean? So he kind of stayed away.
What part of Rodney's personality became so father-like to you? Because if you look at Rodney,
yeah.
I mean, Rodney was certainly different than the person that we saw on The Tonight Show, complaining about everything and I don't get no respect and everything.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I think you'd have to admit, he was a very unusual figure to be such a great father figure to you. I mean, yeah. Rodney was just fantastic.
He was terrific, and you know, and we had a really. He knew that I really loved him and cared for him and watched out for him, and was honest to him. You know, he'd call me, man. What do you think of this? You know, and every night I would get phone calls in the middle of the night. Harry, do you think this is funny? Or you know, sometimes he'd smoke pot and he'd get crazy and have all these wild ideas, and sometimes he'd have these ideas that he'd want to do something that could make me money, you know, like, hey man, I want to finance this, I want to do this. And I'd tell him if something, you know, wasn't good or that you're wasting your time or somebody else did this and why would you want to do that? I could have just said yes and made money and gotten a paycheck. But I think he totally respected that I was honest with him, mm-hmm. you know. But we just had a really good relationship, you know, from working doing stand-up together. One day he said, you know, do you want to write something? And it was this fourth tenor project, and mm-hmm. we wrote it 11 years before we made the movie. And he showed me two treatments. And I remember your brothers came to see me. I was at Valley Forge in Pennsylvania. And Rodney showed me backstage in the dressing room two treatments. He said, which one do you like better? And I said, this one, Serenade Cafe, where he drinks wine and becomes an opera singer. He goes, me too. Could you believe Warner Brothers, they're hiring two writers to do the other one? He goes, how would you like to write a treatment with me? So he paid me, like, I think, $10,000 to write a 30-page treatment. And he said, you're not going to get any credit on this. This is all my idea. And I said, fine. But I kept adding things to it. And I had just read this screenwriting book that Steve had given me. And I was always a big movie fan. So I'd say, hey, man, you know, it should have something like this, or this character should do that. And then after we did that, he said, hey, how about writing the whole script with me? I'll pay you some more money. So I wound up getting like $25,000, and I bought my first house with that, you know, which was terrific. And after we finished it, you know, we were getting at the end, New Line was interested in it and they were going to make it. And I said, you know, Rodney, if you make, I know I have no credit on this, but if you make it, I'd just love to be involved some way, you know, either be an assistant to you or whatever. And he goes, don't worry, man, you'll be involved. And after we finished the whole script, I put so much into it. He said, man, I'm going to give you writing credit on this, you know. And so we were like a little bit of a writing team. We were trying to think of other ideas. And then Ladybugs came along and he asked me what I thought about it, and I had a whole bunch of notes. So here I am meeting with Al Ruddy and Sidney Fury and all the, man, my friend Harry, he writes with me, you know? And I went in with all these notes, and they hired us to do the rewrite, and I got to join the Writers Guild, you know, from that. And then met Al Ruddy, the producer of The Godfather, and that was my entree into movie making, all because of Rodney, you know, letting me write that first thing with him.
How many movies did you end up doing with him?
I did five films with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, five feature films. Three of them I just wrote and produced, and two of them I wrote and directed.
And I know at the end part, Harry, because I remember Rodney's, what was his 80th birthday party,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
that I came to. And, you know, Rodney was always very nice to comedians.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, and I don't mean this belittling Rodney at all. I actually mean it admirably, in that he never gave up. I mean, he was doing The Tonight Show,
yeah,
when it seemed like
he shouldn't.
He shouldn't have.
Yeah. You know what?
It seemed like he was making movies. I mean, maybe the end one or,
yeah,
the couple of last ones.
Yeah.
It seemed like, wow, you know, it's, wow, Rodney, you've done a lot.
Well, that was after three heart surgeries.
Yeah.
And then he started getting a little frail.
You've made a lot of money,
yeah,
and and everything, I think, is fine to go and, you know, watch a baseball game and have a glass of iced tea.
Yeah.
But the drive was just unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, and he, to the point where he financed those movies. You know, he had no patience at all, and he would finance a lot of things that he did. You know, like, you know, man, who wants to wait? I'll just put the money into it. His line was, man, if I lose all the money, it won't affect my lifestyle one bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, made me realize, oh, he had a lot of money. And so he financed three of his films.
Which is millions of dollars.
Well, Meet Wally Sparks was like $7 million. He got six back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it made him hot because Trimark put it out, and they had spots during Seinfeld and ER, and he was selling out because he was like all over the place, you know. And then the other two, the ones that I directed, were like $2.5 million, $3 million, you know, which today is nothing, but back then that was a lot of money.
But it's a lot of money when you're writing the checks.
Yeah, he was. He opened up a lot of doors. We just had such a good personal relationship, and this was like before he was married to Joan, you know, Dangerfield. So he took up a lot of my time, personal time. Hey, man, you want to hang out? And, you know, I had two little kids and stuff like that. And he was my boss, but he was also like my friend and mentor. And so sometimes he'd just want to, you know, have me come hang with him, you know, between working on projects. He loved when we wrote together. He loved to write. This guy carried a pad around in his pocket. He'd be on a walk and then just think about something and just write it down. Jokes, ideas for a special. I remember I gave him an idea once, and he walked towards the bathroom, stopped in his tracks, turned around with this big expression, man, I just came up with this great idea for an HBO special, you know? And then he'd do it. He'd move it along. And next thing you know, a month later, we're sitting on the set shooting this thing. It was pretty wild, you know? And he loved comedians, Tom. He really loved, you know, he handpicked people. He loved to help people out. He was like, man, I wish I had something going so I could use this guy. You know, he took a lot of pride in that. He was very proud of Sam Kennison and Dice's success, you mm-hmm. know,
from who came specials. Off the special.
And Roseanne on his special and Jim. I mean, he kind of brought Jim here, like, you know, he saw Jim in Canada and then said, hey, how would you like to come open for me in the, you know, in Vegas and in L.A. and stuff like that? I mean, Jim would have probably came here anyway, but Rodney kind of gave him his first taste of, you know, performing here in the U.S., you know, mm-hmm. big venues.
Now, I can't take up too much of your time. I mean, I think that's, look, you could write a book on Rodney and your relationship mm-hmm. just alone.
On rolling papers.
Yeah.
Printed on rolling papers,
I mean,
right?
My gosh, the guy, well, he had boasted to us, you're not a druggie, I'm not a druggie. Yeah. And I remember, you remember that dinner
yeah.
when we were opening for him in Detroit, and he looked at us with great pride with his open robe and said, fellas, I've been high for 50 years.
Yeah. I'm a bad boy, okay?
Yeah. You know, we said, oh, well, I guess congratulations. And he really wanted to make a point of it. No, you don't understand. Now, I don't mean I smoke pot. I mean I was high
yeah.
for 50 years.
Yeah, he was smoking in the ICU on a couple of surgeries, you know.
Harry, we can't remember that when we had the boxing match at your house, which yeah. Harry, for those of you who don't know, we'll get on his big screen TV, one of the big boxing matches, those pay-per-views. And it's a wonderful time because comedians from everywhere, from every era come
yeah.
and come together. And this was one of those nights. And we're saving Rodney a chair because Rodney's going to come. And yeah. Louis Anderson is bringing Rodney.
Yeah.
So everyone, you know.
I think it was the Tyson-Lewis fight.
Yeah, so everyone wants to take care of Rodney because Rodney's been so kind to everyone. Yeah. So finally, Louis comes in and he's with Rodney. And
yeah.
Rodney comes in, and God bless him, he's got the safari shirt thing that's
with the mustard stains on it.
Completely open.
Yeah.
He's got cargo shorts that aren't even zipped, let alone having right. a belt. He's
yeah.
kind of like holding them up
right.
with one arm because they're completely unzipped.
No underwear, and the testicles hang out when
no
he sits
underwear.
Down.
And he's coming into the house. So we okay, Rodney, we got a seat for you.
Yeah.
And it's, of course, the seat of honor
yeah.
in front of the fight. And Rodney sits in the chair, starts bringing from all these safari jacket pills, you know,
yeah.
the pills he has
yeah.
to take. So he's spilling pills everywhere.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
opening pill bottles and pills are going over and I'm over here. Rod, here's your pill. Wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
take it. So, you know, we're trying to get the right pills in a row so
right.
we can take them and put the spilled pills
45
back
pills a day.
Exactly.
Man. 45 pills.
And we're
day.
Putting them back into bottles.
Yeah.
And then he goes, hey, can somebody give me a grape soda? Grape. Grape soda. So we're like, okay, Roddy, we'll
yeah.
get him a grape. We actually get him a
yeah.
grape soda.
Yeah.
He starts taking the pills like one at a time with the grape soda. And okay, fine. Okay, he's done with the pills. He's had his grape soda. He's dribbling grape soda down his
yeah.
gut and everything. We're fine. The bout's about to start. And, you know, he pulls out a gigantic joint.
Yeah, he asked permission, though, you know.
Oh, did he ask permission? Because
yeah,
I was
yeah,
like,
no, no.
there are
he
kids
said,
here.
He goes, Harry, man, do you mind if I light up in here? And no one could smoke in our house. We never had it.
Yeah.
Two people smoked in our house. Robert Davi smoked a cigar once at a poker game while Laura was out of town, and I had to keep the windows open for like 3 days to air it out. And Rodney smoked a joint. But Rodney kind of paid for the house in a sense.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, of course, I wasn't going to say no to him.
Right.
Make him go outside.
But it was just this bizarre
yeah.
scene
yeah.
of him smoking this joint. But then he just fell asleep.
Yeah, he'd fall asleep sometimes. I remember him falling asleep once eating a sandwich in a limo. We were playing like Wisconsin, you know, and he had just had heart surgery, and it's our first time back performing, and I'm thinking, he's eating a sandwich, and you know how, like, you know, your eyes start to close a little, and the sandwich goes down, and the chewing stops.
Mm-hmm.
We hit a bump. He starts chewing again and starts to bring the sandwich back up to his mouth with his eyes closed, okay? And I'm standing there in fascination, just looking at him, watching him eat the sandwich, thinking to myself, oh, my God, he's going to choke. I have to give him the Heimlich, and I'm going to bust open his heart again. You know what I mean?
Right.
But he used to fall asleep at the table when we were writing sometime. And one time, he's just asleep. So I decided to put my arms down and close my eyes too, just jokingly, waiting until he woke up and saw me. And Joan Dangerfield walks in and sees the two of us like it's nap time.
Sleeping,
you know
on
what
the
I mean?
Table.
Just sleeping on the table, yeah.
But then, but he finally woke up.
And oh, he woke up.
He
yeah.
woke up.
But
and
he would smoke
bow.
Pot everywhere, man. I mean, he was in the ICU, and there's all these signs that say, you know, there's all these oxygen tanks and no smoking, this, that. And he's lighting up, and the nurse comes in. Sir, you can't smoke in here. Honey, give us a minute, would you? Okay. You cannot. I'm calling security, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, Harry, hold this. And he gives me a vial and a joint. I'm going, Rodney. He goes, man, I got no pockets, you know. So I'm like his bag man now, and the security comes up and he goes, I'll never do it again, boys. Never do it again. You know what I mean? And but he used to do that all the time, smoking in the ICU. He would get taken away by ambulance. He lived at this beautiful apartment on Wilshire Boulevard called the Wilshire. It's a real cool Art Deco building. And he goes, in the middle of the night, they would see him being taken away by ambulance, you know, and there'd be a false alarm. So he goes, they'd always think, like, this is the night I'm going to die. The next day, I'm walking in the pool smoking a joint. You know what I mean? But he had a lot of big, like, Carol Burnett lived in that building, Charlie Sheen, and it's gorgeous, gorgeous building. You know, he loved to smoke pot.
Did he finally, at the very end of his life, did he have plans for more movies?
He got surgery. The surgery that killed him, and he went into a coma. You know, he had to have this heart surgery because all of his arteries were getting blocked up, right? But he also had to have brain surgery. And he didn't know whether or not he had to have the brain surgery first to have the heart surgery. So his front desk, he got a memo from the doctor, and they wrote it on this memo paper, and it said, Mr. Dangerfield, your doctor called. He said you have to have the brain surgery before you have the heart surgery. And he put this in his book. You know, he has a copy of it. He's like, man, these are the memos I get. You have to have the brain surgery to get the heart surgery. So he had the brain surgery, and all this extra oxygen was going to his head, and he was like a mile a minute. Harry, man, we're going to do this. We're going to do Charlie Chan, the movie. Joan said, Harry, he's like got so much energy right now. Just humor him. He had all these plans, all these dates he was booking. It was insane. Then he came down off of it and just started canceling everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just really sad. But he lasted another year and a half before he had to have the heart surgery. It bought him some time. And then they said, you know, you have to have this heart surgery. You're a walking time bomb. Now, he could have not had it and maybe lived a couple of more years. But he wanted to perform. The night before his surgery, I was in there with David Permit, the producer, and Bob Saget. And Rodney was like going, man, Harry, you think if I was to just do a 40 minutes or a half hour and I had you and another comic open for me, people would still pay to come see me? And I said, of course, Rodney. He wanted to work, Tom. He still wanted to work. He wanted to do movies. And I remember,
and he must have been, what, 84?
He was 82.
82.
82. And I remember being in that room, and David Permit was following him around with a camera and videotaping him. And Roddy kept saying, man, I want you to meet my doctor. He's great. He's brilliant. He's British, man, and he's just brilliant, right? And he wanted me to meet this doctor.
This was not Dr. Vinnie Bumbas.
I don't know. It was not Dr. Vinnie Bumbas. So Bob Saget and I are in there. The doctor comes in while Rodney's in the bathroom in his room, right? And the doctor comes in, and Joan goes, oh, this is Harry, Rodney's writing partner and opening act. They've done movies together. This is Bob Saget. He's a filmmaker, and David Permit. So the guy, typical Hollywood, starts to pitch us a movie, okay?
As Rodney's in his bathroom.
Rodney's in the bathroom. And Rodney wanted me to wait for this doctor because he's brilliant. So the doctor starts telling us this plot about a guy whose head is removed, surgically removed, and kept in a tin and put onto another body. It's almost like Frankenstein, right,
sure. Right?
And he's saying that technically this could be done, and he's pitching this and that. And he looks up at David Permit, who's got the camera, and he goes, this isn't on, is it? And he goes, no. And you see the blinking light, right? So Permit is just smiling. We're listening to this pitch. Rodney comes out. The doctor's in the middle of the pitch. Rodney thinks he's talking about the procedure. He looks over at me with a big smile and sits down, right? And then we remove the head and we put it in a pan. And Rodney's eyes are like, what the F is going on here? And he's going, and then we put it on another body. And Rodney's like getting real nervous. And we're like, no, Rodney, he's pitching a movie. He thought he was talking about his procedure.
Man, but that is Hollywood, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Totally
the guy's doctor.
And then I remember that night walking down the hallway with Saget, and I was scared. I said, Bob, I have a feeling we're not gonna see him again. He goes, no, man, he's gonna pull through. And the surgery was successful, but he went into a coma. And I remember I was leaving to go to Romania to shoot this movie with Chevy Chase. And I felt so bad having to go, but I had to go. And so 2 weeks into the shoot, he died, and I had to leave and come back, you know, for the funeral. But uh-huh. It was sad. You know, she had everyone in the world come visit him in the hospital. You know, Leno, Jim Carrey, Adam Sandler, Dice, Roseanne, you know, all these huge comics, the Chris Rock, the biggest stars, you know, all came. And Permit got a lot of this on film, them talking to him. You know, Joan was hoping he would wake up. But then the longer he stayed in it, his organs started to shut down. And, you know, he started getting blockage again. He would have had to have another surgery.
Right.
Know? So it was sad, but his funeral was, you know, I'm jumping ahead to the end here, but his funeral was amazing. She threw this amazing party. He's buried at that cemetery in Westwood where Marilyn Monroe is and Billy Wilder. It's right in the middle of nowhere. I mean, not in the middle of nowhere, right in the middle of the city and right off of Wilshire Boulevard. And the pallbearers were Adam Sandler, Jim Carrey, Saget, myself, Rob Schneider, David Permit, Rodney's son, Brian Roy, and his son-in-law, and Michael Bolton.
Michael Bolton?
Michael Bolton. For some reason, Rodney was friends with Michael Bolton.
The musician? The musician. The character from Office Space?
No, the musician. No. The musician. Yeah.
Rodney was friends with Michael Bolton?
Yeah. They both lived in Connecticut. And one day, Rodney's watching The Tonight Show, and Michael Bolton is doing Rodney impressions. Every time he would go on Jay, he would do Rodney impressions to jokes.
Okay.
So Rodney finally called him, "Hey, man, quit doing me," you know, and they became buddies. And Rodney would go to some of his shows, and he would come to his shows because they both lived in Westbury, Connecticut.
Connecticut, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But the legacy of that, the training from Rodney and working on Rodney's movies has led to being a director now.
Right,
being a producer and a director of movies.
A lot of the people I worked with him on his films, like Ladybugs, and you know, they hired me for other films.
So finally, how long did it take between, you know, kind of 11th grade and actually really coming back and doing your own movies?
Yeah, I did movies with Rodney as a producer. You know, like Ladybugs was the first one in 92, and then we did Meet Wally Sparks in 95, and then My Five Wives in 99. So I had worked on these movies with him. And then after working on three films with him as a producer behind the scenes and consultant with the directors, and Sidney Furie, who's a famous director, he did the Ipcrest Files and Lady Sings the Blues. He did Ladybugs and My Five Wives. And My Five Wives in 99, he let me do prep, you know, and he let me in the editing room. So I really learned a lot. And Rodney said, "You're going to direct the next one." And it was the fourth tenor script that we had written 10 years earlier. And he financed it. So it was like I went to this film school with him. You know, I was making a living too. And we shot it for like $3 million here in L.A. and Universal Studios backlot. It was so cool. Like, I have Rodney being chased by peasants with pitchforks and torches on the same streets that Frankenstein was chased on, you know, on the Universal lot. It's pretty cool. And so I guess that was 2001 was my first movie I directed.
Which brought you into a period, this last period of your life, which you're still doing stand-up, but you're producing a lot. You're directing a lot. And what are you working on now? Or what are a couple of... You know, so that I don't have to take you through the whole thing, but what a couple of noteworthy things in this, you know, contemporary.
Well, you know, I'd gone from comedy. I did you know, it's so funny. All the actors that I work with are like aging actors. I did a Burt Reynolds comedy, you know, that he was starred in with Al Ruddy, who wrote and produced The Longest Yard. He wrote another movie for Burt Reynolds, and that was called Cloud Nine. It was a volleyball movie where Burt coached.
So when you're directing a star like that, you're coming in and you're the director now.
Yeah.
And you know the guys and you know the producers and everything, and you're kind of the man. You're kind of the guy.
But I was go ahead.
But I mean, what is that like when you're working with the sort of aging big star.
Yeah, I was afraid. I was afraid to work with him because I had heard he had just punched a director on his last.
Punched somebody?
Yeah, on his last. You know, Bert punched a lot of directors, you know?
Uh-huh.
So he had just punched a director on his last movie, okay? So I was looking for this script supervisor that wasn't very good, but he was as big as you. Okay.
Oh.
So I'm trying to hire that guy because I figured at least I'll have this big script supervisor sitting next to me that I could hide behind. And the producer goes, "Is he good?" I said, "I don't care. He's huge. You know what I mean?" And I'll hide behind him. But Bert couldn't be any nicer. He was just a sweetheart of a guy. He blew up a couple of times, punched walls, and, you know, you wouldn't do this to Jimmy effing Stewart, you know, and all that, because we made him wait for about an hour one day, you know. So, but he was just great. He was a gentleman. All the actors loved him. A lot of actors said yes to the movie because they wanted to work with him. And he was just a sweetheart of a guy, a hugger. If he did yell, he'd apologize to you later on. And he was just nice. But I went from Rodney to Bert to Chevy Chase, you know. So I'm like, geez, am I ever going to do anybody under 40, you know, directing anybody under 40? And then I wound up doing these horror films. I did a couple of low-budget horror movies, which was a lot of fun in Oklahoma. But again, it was with Gray Fredrickson, who produced The Godfather, you know, 1, 2, and 3. And all this came from my relationship with Rodney. So I didn't – all these movies, I had no agent. I was just getting them from other producers.
From other earlier relationships. Yeah, that they
Right. And recently, my last project, I did a movie last year. I produced and did second unit directing on a movie called Sleeping Around with Michael McKean, who was wonderful, and Jesse Bradford from Swim Fan, and a bunch of young actors, Chris Marquette. And they're shopping that around right now. We shot it in Charlotte last summer. And then I have I'm showrunner on the Jada Gray Show, this kids show. We did 14 episodes. It's sort of like a Sunny with a Chance or a Hannah Montana. And we just sold it, and it's going to air on CBS Saturday mornings.
Great, Harry. In February. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that's great.
Yeah, because you've been a showrunner. You're kind of, I mean, that's your show.
Yeah.
You're executive producing
it. It's a lot of fun, and it's a sketch show and a sitcom, and it's all shot in Vegas. You know, we shot the whole thing in Vegas.
Yeah, you're almost, are you kind of living in Las Vegas? Do you have a
place?
Well,
I live in a hotel when I go there, but I've got a lot of strong ties there now. I mean, the studio that we shot this, my partner, Joseph Murhi, who produced The Fourth Tenor with me with Rodney and Back by Midnight, he owns a movie studio in Las Vegas behind the Palms Hotel. And we shot the Jada Gray Show there, and we do other things there, and now we're vested with Jamie Masada with the Laugh Factory.
Right, so you were a part owner at the Laugh Factory, which
right,
is a big club.
In Las Vegas.
Yeah. In Las Vegas,
yeah.
At the Tropicana.
Yeah, the Tropicana Hotel.
So you're an investor in there. You're performing there quite a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're also an investor.
I'm sort of like the general manager too, and I'm the third one of the owners, and so kind of running it. And
you're producing out of a site, a movie production site.
Yes.
Where you did your Jada Gray Show.
Right, right.
That's now going to be on CBS on mornings.
Right. So we want to try and do, now that we have this club and we have all this comedy talent, we want to try to do, like, remember the Evening at the Improv kind of show? We'd love to do something like that from the Laugh Factory Club and help put it on the map. Right. Since I'm there, we have the cameras, we have the facility, the crew there. So I want to try to do more TV production.
Now, you've gone, kind of as Rodney did, but still a performer.
Yeah.
But you've gone really to comedy impresario. To producing shows.
That's a big word.
Yes, thank you. It's to producing shows and to being the guy in charge and actually the guy looking for the talent. Is that fun? Being the guy now, being the guy who parts owner of the club and running
things?
You know
what? Being part owner with the club, I mean, Jamie Masada is the boss. Jamie is a genius. You know, I mean, he's got one of the hottest comedy clubs in the country, the Laugh Factory. And he's always been a good friend and friend with my partner, Joseph Murray. And so when we found this room, the cool thing about this room, Tom, is this was Rodney's club back in the 80s. Remember he had a club at the Trop?
Oh, sure.
So it's all come full circle that this was Rodney's place. And then it was the Comedy Stop for years and then Brad Garrett's club for about a year and a half. So there's been comedy on this corner for 25 years and it's doing really well right now. The Trop loves the Laugh Factory and it's tough because I have guys calling me to showcase.
I didn't even think of that, Harry.
And sometimes I'll book a guy and he may not be cutting it. And I'll just, rather than fire him, I'll like cut his time or something like that, where maybe the guy should be fired, you know, but I just want to give him a shot. But, you know, because he's an MC. I mean, you've worked with guys on the road, and I'd say, hey, who did you work with last week? And you go, geez, I really don't remember. You know what I mean? Because there's so many of these guys. And sometimes there's a guy that you go, he's the same guy that I worked with last week, but not really, because they're doing the same jokes, you know?
Well, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of tough, you know? But then I'll just try to be constructive. I'll say, hey, man, you know, you should really do this or do that. And don't try not to be so dirty. You know, I mean, if I use you, I'm going to use you as a host. What makes you think you can do all of that edgy, dirty, mean-spirited stuff if I'm going to use you as a host first? So you got to change it up a bit, you know?
But as I've said, Harry, I don't find it that edgy, because I don't think you can call it an edge if everyone's standing on it, you know? There's a lot of edgy quote.
I can't believe all the race material today. It's like every other comic is just talking about, you know, this race and that race. They all make fun of Mexicans, though. It's like that's free reign. Anybody can make fun of a Mexican. But there are so many comedians that have found a niche just because of what their race is, whether it's a Hindu comic or Arabic or Hawaiian.
Oh, you mean the person on stage is speaking of their own race?
Yes, but then they all talk about the race-related material while they're on stage. But yeah, there's like, you know, like I've even done, I'm 100% Greek. I did a Greek show in Chicago, you know, my big fat Greek comedy show, which I was a little offended about the fat thing, because, you know, I am overweight, but they actually blew my face up fatter on the marquee.
Did they really?
Because Angelo Sarakis is about like 300 pounds. So it was the two of us and had our two fat faces up there. But I was like, man, maybe I need to get in with this. Remember years ago, you and I and Steve were going to try to do the Good Guys comedy tour?
Of course.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like if you can be part of that wise guys of comedy, or the
whatever of comedy,
or the blue collar guys, or the, what was the black kings of comedy,
you know,
and all that kind of stuff. It can really help market yourself.
So you were talking about the young people that you saw now doing comedy and everything.
Yeah.
But with the with the young person that comes up to you now, either as a producer or director or a performer, like what do you recommend that people do who want to get in there? You know, the young person who wants to eventually maybe be part owner of a comedy club and produce movies and direct things perform?
I think if you want to perform, just think about where you're going to fit in. You know, let's say you want to be a headliner, or you want to play clubs and make money, or casinos and whatever. Just think about, go to a show. Go to that show that you want to be in. Watch what you see, not to steal anything, but to realize, hey, I have to be slick. I have to have a gimmick. I have to have an image or an edge. Because there's these guys that are playing bars in Vegas. And there was a comic who got a glass shoved in his face because he started making fun of some people and said some really mean racial things from the stage. And it's like, I feel sorry for the guy, but it's like, what makes you think you could do that? And granted, it was crazy that this person shoved a glass in his face, you know, and cut him. I feel terrible for the guy, but it's like getting stage time is great. Do you want to go somewhere with that? I mean, do you want to just keep doing your day job and just perform at night and piss people off or sometimes get laughs? Or do you want to move to the next level? And that's what we used to do when we were at the Comedy Store. Mitzi always used to say it was like a college. We would perform. We wanted to get road gigs to make money. We wanted to get on TV shows. We wanted to get movie deals. We wanted to showcase and move up. So I say that to these guys that are working, to think about where do you see yourself a year from now? Where do you see yourself 2 years from now? And do what you have to do to get there. But listen, a guy these days, you know, there are all these bring me shows. They didn't have them when we were starting out. You know, you'd stand in line, you'd sign up. You get hired to be a paid regular or a non-paid regular, and then you get spots. Now there are guys that produce shows. They'll say to the Laugh Factory or the Comedy Store, hey, let me have Tuesday night.
Right.
I'll book the show with 20 comics, and
I'll promote it.
But all 20 of these comics are going to bring 20 paid guests.
Yep.
So then you say to this comic, you're going to get on in the main room, but you have to bring 20 people that are going to buy tickets at $10 a piece. And they're called bring me shows.
Right.
And there's a ton of those. Clubs all over the country are doing that. So now someone can get a valid videotape with them performing, you know, a horrible set in the main room of the Comedy Store with that logo behind them.
Exactly. You have to have that photograph for your Facebook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For your Facebook pages. You on stage with the improv logo behind you, right, on the brick wall.
I let a lot of guys do guest sets at the club in Vegas. And then we take their pictures for them and give it to them when they leave, and they all put it on their Facebook page. But it just also promotes the club, you know,
sure,
what I mean? Because they say, hey, I was at the Laugh Factory. Now somebody, let's say they have 500 friends or whatever. Everyone knows now there's a Laugh Factory at the Tropicana.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So are you still having fun?
I'm having a great time. Just got to lose weight. It's so hard. You know, when you get older, I look at some old pictures and I go, oh my God, look at how young and cute I was. And now I look like my mom.
But people should know you're so athletic in your act on stage that several times you've been seriously injured. Because haven't you? Because, I mean, you jump all, all over the place.
I was at that Miami
Improv
Coconut Grove, and I do this Forrest Gump thing where I run around the room, and it's my first night there, and that Rebel Rouser music is playing, and the audience is clapping. I run in the back of the theater, and it's dark, and I went over this railing, and I thought that the floor was at the same level, but it was a pit, and people were sitting in stools, and I tore my ACL, and I'm laying there screaming and cursing, and no one knows if this is part of the show, right, or whatever. The manager comes over. Is this part of the show? And I'm like, no. He carried me on stage, and I had him finish my act for me. I had him act out everything, you know. But it was terrible. I had to have surgery, and I finished out the week. Show must go on, you know.
So I was the next night. You were on stage.
I had an immobilizer on. I had my props on a table. I could only get dressed in half of my costume. I was limping around and on Vicodin and just doing my act. But they were rude. You know what was funny is they were videotaping me that night for a show called Deco Drive, and it was just supposed to be a piece like appearing this week at the Improv, mm-hmm, but they aired it like a hard copy piece. Sure, he's laughing now, but watch what happens when a comic falls down. And they kept like showing it before we went to commercial and played it like a hard copy piece. It was pretty funny.
Well, Harry, I mean, I won't take up any more of your time. You're just, you know, we've been buddies for so very long, and you've always, you've just always been such a great guy to everyone, and it's a testament to you that even now, 2012, when you have one of the boxing matches at your house, the place is packed with comedians.
Oh, my God. You know, I have home movies from your, I have like some Super 8 movies, not Super 8, sound video from like your house over in Westchester when you used to live there, and Caroline was pregnant, and Bob Saget wouldn't stop talking, and he was just like, it was hysterical. He just like did this whole stand-up bit, you know, it was him giving a tour of your house.
Over at our first house,
yeah. Did I ever give you a copy of that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, he actually pulled a baby. Somebody else had a child, and he pulled it out of, like his wife was pregnant at the time, and he pulled it from between her legs. It was hysterical. Then he interviewed your dog. He was talking to the dog for
Bob
a while. You know, Bob, if you put a camera on him, he would just go, you know?
But it's such a great thing to have so many friends like you, and thanks for...
Hey, I really enjoyed the show. I've listened to the Mark Hamill one and the Blake Clark one and the Mark McClure.
Uh-huh, sure.
Yeah, that was a great one, too, and it's a great show. Congratulations with it.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for being on. I appreciate it.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, that's the end of my conversation with Harry Basil. But Harry was very generous to let me come up to his house at an undisclosed location in Los Angeles and talk to him for such a long time. I really appreciate it. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries, for all their help. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for giving me this magnificent guitar that I use in the live show. Hey, consider buying my book, Would You, The Masked Man? Consider telling a friend about the podcast, or subscribing to the podcast, because most of all, I thank you for your support, for your ears, and we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.